Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 26, 2016, and welcome to episode 129 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and reminiscing about all things 80s, and 70s, and 60s. But for today, let's reminisce about the 80s. Hi, I'm Mike Mulhern, and with me today, we have up in sunny Canada. Hi, Carrington.
Hello, it is sunny Canada.
It's better than cold and miserable Sydney. It's raining here. It's 0 degrees Celsius. Charming.
Is it really?
It is.
Wow.
Not charming at all. Jack, what's it like in your end of the world?
Well, we just had Midsummer Weekend here in Sweden, which is always a big celebration. People are glad that it's the longest day of the year, the most sunlight. But of course, that also means that it actually rains most of the weekend. So what are you going to do?
Stay inside and play with your retro computers.
There you go. Perfect.
And speaking of a man with lots of retro computers to play with, Paul, how have you been?
I have been well. I just came back from a week at the beach. That was not very retro computing heavy. Though, actually, the beach was pretty close to the InfoAge Center, which I did not visit this time. But
Okay, so you didn't have any problems keeping the sand out of the floppy drives?
No, I left the floppy drives at home.
That's good. Okay, well, I'm glad everyone's feeling good. So I thought that we'd go with a suggestion of one of our listeners. Was the tech in the 80s better than today? So apart from the fact that in the 80s that it was all new, and today, it's another laptop. It's another phone. Back then, it was all new. It was great. Everything was popping up roses. So, man on the spot in Toronto. What do you think, Carrington?
I think no. I don't know if it's going to be a popular answer, but no, not in the least. We live in a world that simply gets better and better and better in most, if not always. I would rather live now than any time before now. There are some things about tech in the 80s and earlier tech that I prefer, but overall, absolutely without question, my answer is no. Things have gotten better, and hooray for better. Two things that are mentioned in this particular little guide, which I think is kind of tongue-in-cheek anyway, are the first that you owned your media, and I'm a big fan of that. I like when I buy a thing that I've actually bought it. Nowadays, if you click a buy it now button on something, you're not buying anything. You're getting a limited term lease on some digital thing that you can't – drives me crazy. So ownership, I prefer. So I miss owning my own tech, and the lack of DRM, which kind of goes hand-in-hand with not owning stuff. Digital rights management can – bite me, hate everything about it. But other than that, everything is faster, everything is sleeker, everything is connected, and I still have all the stuff from the 80s, thus this podcast, thus going to Kansas Fest. I still have all of that, and I have all of this. So it's the best of all possible worlds, except I don't own anything, and DRM is getting in my way. But other than those things, yay now, and also yay then, but bigger capital yay now.
Well... I like that.
I mean, Atari is dead now. The world is better. Commodore is a shell of what it used to be. World is better in all ways. You know, the right computer company is still around, and those other things are gone. This is not an approval.
And this is coming from – you must be a Microsoft fan then, Carrington.
I don't hate them the way I used to. I am kind of a bit – much more of a fan now than I was back when they had actual power.
You've mellowed. Okay.
Oh, yes. This is mellow, Carrington.
Carrington firing off at a massive 1 megahertz there at the 80s. Okay. Jack.
That's what I'm saying. Down with retro.
Oh, down with retro? Oh, where's the delete button?
What's going on here?
Oh, shock. Jack, save us.
Well, I think, Carrington has a very good point. Like, when it comes to actual... Well, he has a good point. He's wrong, but he has a good point. So the good point is that... DRM is terrible, and like in terms of actual usefulness of things we have today, like my MacBook can do so much more than anything I ever had 30 years ago, right? It's just, you can't even compare. But there was what I think is lacking today is the kind of approachability and accessibility of the devices that we're using. So 30 years ago, you could buy an 8-bit computer and take it home and learn to program, and like within some dedicated effort, within a few weeks, you could write some games, you could write some software, you had some basic abilities to like learn things and the documentation and resources to learn a programming language. Today, like if you want to write software, you could write simplistic software today, but you couldn't write software that looks anything like the software that you see that you buy in a store or online or whatever. So like, and I think this is something that like kids growing up today, they see these incredible 3D realistic games, and if they're going to make any effort to try and program a game like what they're seeing, it's just impossible. Like the amount of knowledge you need to get into that is just huge. Whereas we could buy games or pirate games 30 years ago, and the things that we could actually look at and see as examples, they were not completely unreachable. I mean, sure, I never made any really decent games 30 years ago, but I at least made some half-ditch efforts at trying things out, and I could see that I was making some progress and actually making some things move on the screen and see some things happening. Whereas I think like today, what computers can do is so far advanced that it's almost impossible to see the path to get to something that looks what is a standard looking game or piece of software today. I think that the amount of knowledge it requires to really get into the details is just huge. And I think that's off-putting for a lot of young people, actually.
I think you're completely misremembering what it was like. Because I think if you go back to the 1980s and you take any published action game that was made in Assembler, and we'll take like Ultima and a really good Infocom game, all text but with an amazing parser, and you sit – anybody, you're going to pick a person at random who was 45 years old at the time and didn't have a computer background or a science background and tell them, pick whichever one you'd find easier and duplicate it. Not a hope in heck. The tiny few of us who were nerds at the time and who loved this stuff, we would dive in and maybe with a bunch of effort be able to do it. But my mom could never have recreated a game no matter how much time I gave her. She couldn't do it then. She couldn't do it now. Neither could my sister now or then. And my nephew today couldn't. And I bet you back then he wouldn't have been able to, because he just wasn't a super nerd who would sit down with a book and teach himself the assembler codes or something. Most people wouldn't do it then, and most people wouldn't do it now. And yeah, the games now are much more advanced, and you need like a team of quindunkies to make a game, and you only needed one quindunky back then, but there's not a lot of dunkies in the world no matter how you want to slice up your games. So I don't think it was that accessible to the general public back then, because most people weren't interested, and even if they were, they wouldn't have had the time or the wherewithal, their money or whatever. I think it was just a few of a minority of nerds, and now it takes a group of nerds to do it, but I don't think it's actually like in round numbers actually more accessible than now for the general public to make things. I think it's just a rounding error of difference.
Well, that is true. I mean, some people do not have the aptitude or the interest or whatever, and that was the case then and now. But I think still, like say today, most people's inroad today into computer technology is a telephone. It's an iPhone or it's an Android phone. That's what kids start off with having, you know, that's what many people, I know adults who do not have any sort of computer at home except a phone. And it's and which is totally weird to me, but that's the only way they interact with the internet, that sort of thing. I mean, not many, but I know a few people like this. And if all you have today is a phone, you can't program that thing at all. You can't do anything. Like, the level of complexity to make even just some shapes appear on your phone is like that. Well, that's going to require you to have a computer. And if you're talking about Apple, you have to like pay an annual membership fee in order to actually run things on your device, all this kind of stuff. So I think there is a bigger gap there's a different sort of threshold now that didn't exist at the time. Like at the time, you could buy a computer and program on that computer, often with the built-in basic cartridge, which is right there. Whereas nowadays, it's like you have to, if you have a brand new computer, there's nothing on it that's going to let you program it. At least not that the average user can understand and know about. And there's just so many different ways to do it. You got to figure out, okay, which, I mean, sure, like a Mac has built in, it's got Python and Ruby and Perl and everything else, but like the normal user doesn't know how to do that. And like, it's just not an obvious thing to sort of say, okay, now I'm going to start programming this thing. I think there was more of an obvious path to start programming then for newcomers than there is now. So, Anyway, this is pretty far off topic of the actual technology itself.
However, I might put in that, although I think everybody's right,
no, we're all wrong.
Someone who didn't know that they wanted to program doesn't have a way in like they used to. Like, you know, before you could look at a game and you could say, oh, you know, I could do that. You know, that's not that hard. I could do that. Maybe I'll learn how to do that. Even if I didn't know ahead of time that I wanted to be able to do that. Whereas now you would sort of look at the 3D game and then you'd say, this is magic. You know, I have no idea. I guess also it's sort of similar to the, you know, there's a set of people who will use a VCR, you know, but don't know how to program it. You know, they can hit play and they can hit stop, and there's a bunch of other buttons that just get in the way. And you know, you wouldn't expect them necessarily to try to get any further with it. But I guess it's the thing that the old tech had was the ability to hook you in easily without predisposition to want to do that.
Yeah, well, actually, I think I agree with Carrington, but...
Fools, all of you!
but that's just one nerd's perspective of it. Now, what I really loved about tech in the 80s was its newness. It was, to me, it was a radical departure from virtually everything which I had grown up with. I didn't get to my first computer until I was 16 and started university. Until then, it was just something that you saw in movies, you know, the blinking lights and those spinning tape things. And it was something I thought I'd never see a computer, and I don't see, you know, how I could actually use one if I did. Then I went to university, found the computing lab, and it was just like being whacked across the back of the head with a piece of 2x4. It was shocking, and I just loved it. It just turned my world upside down, the potential that you could do with them, and just getting in and programming. And
it might have been a concussion, though.
Apart from the concussion, it was great. But it was that kind of threshold to me. A lot of people were introduced to computers at various levels of their schooling, and I think, you know, had a much gentler introduction to the world of, well, I just call it technology, because at home we had a radio and a TV, and that was it, and we weren't allowed to touch either of them. You know, that was something controlled by the parents. Even in our teens, the TV just sort of, it sat down there. We sort of watched it together as a family. But once I got introduced to computers, that was something that I could control. That was something that I could do. And, you know, I taught myself programming. Literally, I saw games and I thought, I think I could do that, and taught myself to code. And then I realized that, some of these programs are just a little bit harder than I originally thought, and this lot are a pile of very simplistic code, for want of a better term. But, it was great. But onto other aspects of 80s technology. The one I miss is batteries. I've just recently had a bad run of batteries in phones and batteries in other things, and they're all built in, so you got to plug the ruddy thing into a charger. And I miss being able to just reach into the drawer and grab out a 2, 3, 4 AAA batteries and just slam them back in the device, and you're back to 100% power. You know, instant recharge. So I miss batteries, and funnily enough, I miss VCRs. The comment that in here said, no, VCRs, you had unlimited storage. Well, at least as unlimited as the amount of tapes that you've got. You know, I've got PVRs and software hooked up to computers, and I'm always running out of space. And you know what you've recorded, the titles there. At least with VCRs, you go, oh, I don't remember what's on that tape. I didn't write on it. Ah, slam it in. But I agree with Carrington so much as that I would rather be living with the tech of today, but I think the tech of the 80s to me was better in the sense of the change that it wrought, not just on me but on society. It was a very interesting time. I'm glad that I learnt computers in the 80s. I would have loved to have learned about computers in the 70s, but I'll have to settle for the 80s. I think that relatively the 80s tech was better, but I'd rather be living with the tech of today.
Yeah, and I hate batteries. In these 30-year-old machines where you know, someone, the battery ran out, they put the battery in, they could use it again, and then they said, all right, I'm tired of this, I got a new thing, I'm going to put this in the closet.
And, with its little bag of acid inside, yeah. It, just ticking away.
And so, like, time passes.
Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this on here before, but I got a Mac 2. I think I did. Just recently, I picked it up, and the motherboard just melted, you know, from the batteries that were in it. So it makes me look quite angrily at batteries now. I see this in this article. By the way, we're referring to an article on TomsGuide.com, which is like a top 10 kind of list of 16 ways tech was way better in the 80s. I don't think we actually said that, but we keep referring to the pictures and things that it was mentioning. But there's this picture of a bunch of batteries, and it just looks to me like a horrible, horrible picture of, you know, contained acid.
But yeah.
For me, it's the aesthetic that I miss. And I realize that it's simply because it's the aesthetic that was around when I first got into technology and when I was in the throes of puberty. And so everything was exciting and new and strange. And I think so because of that, like I look at something like an Apple IIe or an Atari 800 and think, well, that is so much more beautiful than any computer today. And I think I wouldn't argue that those computers are better any more than I would argue that a car from the 1940s or the 1950s or 60s is better than a car today.
Clicky keyboards are better.
But they're prettier. Well, but also there's pros and cons to everything. So I think there's a lot of downsides to the clicky keyboards. I like one, but I don't use it when I podcast, or you couldn't hear me when I was taking notes and work because they're so loud, and I can't use one in an office space. Otherwise, it's just rude. So I think in most ways, most technology has gotten mostly better. But that said, I live a life just roiling with nostalgia and stuck in the 80s completely and loving this technology and going to Kansas Fest soon and to be on this podcast. So it's not that I don't dig this stuff. I totally do. But I do think for the general public, most people are probably better off with a modern computer, and I'll just be over in the corner enjoying my slower, less useful things because I find them prettier.
Yep, yeah, I think it's an important point in the aesthetics of it. I think probably someone who is 10, 15 years younger than me probably looks at my favorite technology from that period the way that I look at, like, an old reel-to-reel tape recorder from the 1960s. Like, it's like, that's an interesting thing, but it doesn't have an emotional association for me. It looks like an old thing. Like, that's from before my time, and it's not really something that I have a feeling for. Whereas the things that we're talking about are things that, like, wow, this was our intro to this stuff. And we're, you know,
in the same way that I love big iron from the 1950s and 1960s, giant, but I don't want to use them or collect them. I just sort of vaguely appreciate them. But, you know, an IBM DOS computer from my period, even though I was anti-IBM, will resonate with me. I look at something that pretty. When I look at a Sinclair ZX81, I'll think, oh, isn't that gorgeous? Look at how sleek. That's a useless computer. Look at the keyboard on that. But still it'll chime something inside me because it's from that period where I was becoming the person I am today. I think that's going to be the case with kids today. They will look back on the early model iPhones and they go, isn't that amazing and how cool they are? They used to be a physical thing instead of something you would jam into the slot in the back of your head. And so they'll have nostalgia for that. And we'll be like, oh, you kids, you don't understand luxury. And, you know, it's just you like the stuff that came into the world when you were in high school. And I think that's the case for all of us.
There is, I mean, one of the points that they make, I think in a couple of these things, has to do with kind of like the networked world and, you know, how all your games worked offline and the DRM stuff that where because we have managed to connect all the computers together and that's got huge numbers of, you know, wonderful aspects. You know, the reason that people can listen to this podcast is because all our computers are connected together. That there is a kind of a sense like it's possible people did kind of rush forward with this technological improvement because it enabled things without entirely thinking about, you know, what kinds of things do we want to preserve from the non-networked world? And, you know, what kinds of things are we going to wish we had done in the future when we look back? Because I think, you know, disappearance of things like, you know, eWorld and, you know, all the things, online communities where the backing software disappears and then suddenly all of the content that was there is not there anymore. You know, this is not something that you think about until it's gone. And usually
I feel
gone
like Jason
for a decade.
Scott should be cutting into the call here.
Yeah. So what we do for the stuff from 30 years ago or 40 years ago or whatever is not going to be really equally possible. Well, it depends on how successful, you know, Jason and his evangelism is. But, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's already just lost. And, you know, people 30 years hence are not going to be able to go back and experience things in quite the same way, except through, like, you know, archival YouTube videos or whatever.
And eventually I wonder if anybody will even care about the differences in the same way that I am pretty vague on the difference between 1750s and 1760s. You'll lump them together. And I suspect 200 years from now, people will say, you know, iPhones, candlestick telephones, it's all from that early tech period. Like, it'll just be jammed together as early physical tech. And they won't even know the difference between the 80s, the 90s, the 2050s, the 1920s. It's all the same thing.
Look forward to reminiscing back then.
Hopefully your brain jar is within sight of my brain jar, and we can talk about it.
I suppose we'll be networked. Okay. Well, I think we've conclusively proved that we don't know if the 80s were better, but it might be better today. But there were things that we loved, and that I think we'll just continue to enjoy our 80s tech, maybe some of that other 90s tech as well. No, just the 80s stuff. And we'll just keep on living in the networked age. Okay. Well, it's listener feedback time. So Dean dropped us a line to say that he enjoyed the podcast. Well, thanks, Dean. And he had an unexpected find when he replied to an ad that basically said, pick it up by 4 p.m. today or it's going to the dump. Now, he's a dedicated soul. Since he was doing his PhD, he rushed over. he's got his priorities right. And he picked up some Atari STs, some various Macs, and then the guy said, do you want some old 8-inch floppies? He said, sure, which I think we all would have done. And he took them out of the trash bin, and then he says about a week later or so, he and his friend Ken were flipping through the binder of discs and pointed out that several were from Microsoft, that they were 1978 Fortran compilers, old Microsoft logos with the Albuquerque, New Mexico address. So, yeah, he's also included some shots. We'll put a link to his blog with his collection. And it's great to hear from our listeners about their unexpected finds. I would love to have found a folder full of 8-inch floppies, especially with those older compilers. That's really just hits all the spots of my prime interest. Okay, so we also have a link from John for the 2016 edition of the Glenside Color Computer Club newsletter. Lots of photos from the CocoaFest 2016, and we have a link for you to go and enjoy the PDF of that collection.
Yeah, that I took a look at that actually, and it looks pretty interesting. It's mostly pictures of the last Chicago Cocoa Fest. I think it's like volume 36 or something. It's a long, long running newsletter.
Yeah, it is, and I would like one of these days I've got to get to the next last Chicago Cocoa Fest.
Yeah,
but it's just teeing up the times. Well, it's time for items of interest and news. And Carrington, what is this video all about?
Nothing. Remember, I told you I don't like retro stuff anymore.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if this may not actually be retro.
No. Well.
Okay. Then I do like this. So there's a video that just came out about the mega processor, which I'm still hooked on and still in love with, and think it's totally amazing. So. If you haven't been listening to older episodes or haven't been sort of following it online, the mega processor is this completely ginormous a microprocessor.
At a macro scale.
Exactly, that you can basically walk through. It is a room-sized microprocessor, and it's just – it looks like a trade show display, but it's a working microprocessor, and it's amazing, and I'm so in love with it. And the photos and description from the megaprocessor.com site are great, but there is a new video out, and it really gives you a feel for what this thing is like to be walking around inside it as it's operating, and it's – glorious and gorgeous, and everybody should watch it. So we're gonna have a link to that video, and we will also link again to the Monster 6502, which is the what they call it, the disintegrated circuit. So it's a like a MOS 6502, but working at transistor scale, so also huge. So everything old is massive again, and I'm excited about all these products, and I think they are gorgeous and beautiful, and I love them.
Yeah, well, I suppose the mega processor video is a bit Tronish, where you're actually inside the computer. I just love the walkthrough. I understood the scale of the mega processor when we were just looking at it on the website with the panorama shots of, as you said, just like trade display panels. But you still just didn't get a real scale for what he'd created. But with this video and the walkthrough, it really brings home that it's artistic as well as technological. I just love the whole thing from beginning to end.
If you looked at the pictures from before, there's this, you know, one of the panels is the memory, and it's a it's all LEDs sort of like showing what's in the various parts of the memory. But he's got it set up at the end of the video playing a Tetris game, so. Maybe it's a display. I don't know. But anyway, at any rate, it's a big panel full of LEDs that I'm not going to count for you right now. But pretty low resolution, but pretty actually responsive Tetris game. So very nice.
Okay, Jack, what have you found for us in the wonderful world of Kickstarter?
So I found this cool Kickstarter from Dream Arcades. DreamArcades.com. This is a company that makes they make console multi-game machines for use in bars or restaurants or your home if you feel like it, I suppose. And I've seen these in a couple of places in the U.S. and they're very cool, like professional joysticks, and they're ones that have with like two players and four players and stuff. And it's sort of a MAME setup or whatever it is. Not really quite sure what the software is, but when they sell this in a bar, they have a bunch of licensed games set to go. So now what they've made is a home console version of the same thing. So the console itself is what the Kickstarter is about. The actual device is a little thing styled to look like a little Atari 2600. It has plugs on it for Atari joysticks and for USB joysticks and for an SD card, and it can talk to Bluetooth controllers. And so in their Kickstarter, they actually have things where they're bundling this with a couple of different options. One is sort of a big single panel controller with joystick and a bunch of buttons and a trackball, and one is a mini arcade machine that is like the kind of thing you could, like, I guess you could put it in your lap or on a table in front of you. It has like an 8 or 9 inch screen inside there with a nice joystick and buttons. And this thing looks very, very cool. I think even just the controllers themselves are very cool and would be nice to have. But I kind of like this idea of having this little device. And the device itself is running Windows 10. Boo. Mm-hmm. But it means you can run Windows software on it, I guess. I'm sorry, what did you say?
They didn't want it to.
They didn't want it to.
Downloaded and installed itself.
Yeah. Yeah, they start off with Windows 8, and there you go. And this is actually one thing that concerns me about this thing. Is like, what if you have this, and like suddenly it's going to start doing all the Windows crap, saying, you've got some updates to install. And, you know, I'm just like, I'm just trying to play a game on my TV. But that's why I don't use Windows. Anyway, it seems to have some nice software, and you can add more software to it on the fly, emulators, MAME, all that jazz. Looks pretty cool. The minimum Kickstarter thing is, what, $289, and that's for the thing with the console itself and a little Bluetooth wireless controller. Then they have the portable device, which is like a little cabinet with a screen in it. That's like $600 on the Kickstarter. And then they have the device with a bigger joystick plus trackball controller, separate wireless thing, is $399. So pretty cool. I think it's an interesting contrast to the thing we were talking about a lot a few months ago, the Retro VGS, which is all kind of like this sort of closed up proprietary thing where they wanted to sort of make this new console that looked like an Atari Jaguar, and they never really got it off the ground. This thing, it looks like it has 25 days to go, and they are about almost a quarter of their way to what they have asked for. So who knows, could go. And this is actually being built by a real company that has real experience building actual arcade machines. So it seems like pretty clear that they can actually build this thing if they get the interest they want. So worth checking out, I think.
I think the hardware looks quite nice for the cost of the machines. Normally, I'd be just scoffing at something like this because I'm like, you can do it with MAME or MES or totally do it yourself. This is crazy. But they're neat-looking little devices, so if they're made as nicely as they appear, then a couple $100 for them I think is a pretty decent deal. The downside to this sort of thing is the fact that it's legal, which normally I'm all in favor of. But there are so many rights issues with running these old games and the ROMs and such that when a machine like this is created by an actual proper company like Dream Arcades or any of the ones that do this, the games are incredibly expensive, and you have to buy them in packs that are hundreds of dollars to load in, and it becomes a very locked down system. I see on DreamArcades.com they've got a, you know, you can buy their little console and it's $2,000, and you can spend, you know, $500 to unlock these 12 games, and it's so expensive because there's a lot of rights involved, and I don't want to be saying oh, they're everybody should therefore go pirate it, but the reality of the market is you can just throw MAME or MES on a PC and get all of this for essentially nothing if you have an old computer lying around, or if you want to do it with an incredible, beautiful front end, you would use OpenEMU on a Mac, and it's gorgeous, and you just drag in ROMs, or you can drag in little packs and say, you are now an Atari, and you also are in a television. You're also all these things, and drag in any ROMs, and it's completely illegal, I'm sure, but it's also completely free. And so these companies, I think, are facing the same battle that the music industry did back when their piracy was rampant, and they said, we want to sell CDs for $40. And they said, well, we can have it for free, so give me another offer. And it had to come down to 99 cents a song. And then everyone said, okay, we'll live with that. I think these sorts of systems have to come down to that sort of level when it comes to the games. Otherwise, none of these are going to take off. So we will see. We should link to OpenEMU as well, though, because it's gorgeous and I'm still loving it on my Mac. So.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I do want to say the Dreamcade replay does have a preset list of included games. It's about 100 games, some arcades, some Atari 2600, some casino games, some other stuff. And it says in a disclaimer at the bottom, says Dream Arcades only includes properly licensed games. Add-on games available from stores, blah, blah, blah. All trademarks are property of their respective owners. So this thing is, at the end of the day, this thing is a Windows 10 device. It's running Windows 10. So if you can install an emulator that works on Windows 10, you're done. Like, you don't have to, it's an open platform in that sense that it's, you know, any Windows software that you can get for pay or for free, you can run on this thing. So I think ultimately,
yeah, they're pretty.
Yep. Yep. It's a cute little thing. There's a shot of someone holding it in their hand. It's a
looks only like a tiny little.
Yeah,
<it's>
that. Well, that, but I'm thinking of the other one. The one that looks like a 2600 is a tiny little thing that is in someone's hand with the wood grain and all. But yeah, there's also a picture somewhere of someone with the portable device sitting on their lap, like they're sitting, they're kind of slouched back in a bed somewhere or something with this thing on their lap. It's like, well, that looks heavy on your lap there, guy, but okay.
And the one that looks like a little 2600, if you that's $289 for this Kickstarter price. If you compare that against a flashback, which yes, the flashback is a bunch cheaper, but can only do a limited set of built-in Atari 2600 games, and this right. one is offers everything the flashback does and a ton more. So if you're looking to get something that's just plug and play easy, then this for $289 and you're good to go.
Yep, because it also has that $289 also includes that one wireless controller, and the thing has HDMI out, which I think the flashback does not. So
does the flashback actually have the plugins? Do they like regular joystick plug-in as well?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
But like Aaron said, it's not expandable in any way. So
except the Flashback 2, which technically you can make use carts, but right. for the most part, they're not expandable. So this, I think, when you look at that kind of price, like the $289 one, this Replay Classic, that's a pretty good deal.
Yep.
For a nice plug and play, easy, totally legal. I prefer the Step Up, the one that's the $399, the Dreamcade. I think that's a prettier. That's the sweet spot for me. The one without the built-in monitor, so you got to plug it into a TV. But it's nice looking. I really like the colors of it and the buttons. And for $400, you've got yourself a main machine, all yep. pre-made for you with joystick, button, trackball, the whole bit. Like that's a pretty good deal, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, that one I could imagine getting. I wanted to mention that the middle one, this is, so the Replay Mobile, which is kind of built into a something like a arcade cabinet, reminds me quite a lot of the iCade, which we must have mm-hmm. mentioned at some point. I think it was even a gift idea at one point, but that's something that basically is mm-hmm. an iPad holder. I have a smaller one, which is like an iPhone holder, but has a joystick and buttons that you can Bluetoothly connect to the iPad sitting in it. So if you jailbreak it and run MAME or have one of those, have one of those apps that have MAME hidden inside or whatever, that is also an option that's similar to this and quite a bit cheaper, but looks pretty similar.
Okay. Well, plenty of options there. Back to old computers. I found this link to a Xerox Alto restoration. So for those who aren't overly familiar with the Xerox Alto, this is a great restoration product. There are great photos of the hardware, both at the start, and there's two links. There's the overview of the start and then part one on Ken Sheriff's blog. Now, I just love the fact that someone basically donated their Xerox Alto in for restoration. So Alan Kay recently gave his 1970s Xerox Alto to Y Combinator, as I read from Ken's blog, and I'm helping with the restoration of this legendary system. Well, legendary it is, and these are some very beautiful shots of the machine. Now, a lot of people may not actually be aware of the actual physical size of the Alto. It wasn't a small machine. It was basically a large workstation and processor unit. And there's also, there's the overview and there's also the first restoration steps where it actually shows a 2.5 megabyte hard drive in a cartridge format. So you really get in and see the innards of the Alto. Quite a seminal machine. It is one that I'm hoping that I can see sometime, and I would really love to actually have some time on it. It really, really is a wonderful looking machine. So, guys, no Altos hiding in your collections?
Nope.
If only.
Yeah.
I'm one of the people that didn't realize how big it was. I'd seen tons of photos of the Alto, of course, and I always thought just that top part.
The top section.
I saw this, I'm like, why do they have it sitting on top of an industrial air conditioner unit? I was like, oh my goodness, is that all the computer? So I had no idea all that extra stuff below. In all the ads for the Alto, you see all these beautiful shots. They never show that part. Yeah. They only show that top part from the keyboard.
The portrait monitor, the keyboards sort of sliding under the monitor display. But wait, there's more.
Yeah. So, and I think that other, because the other part is sort of separate, so it could sit on your desk and then wheel the air conditioner to wherever it needs to go. But I had no idea there was that part of it. They really hide that bit in the marketing. So that was something that I learned from this. And it's so beautiful. I love that computer.
This is a particularly nice one too. I mean, you know, it was taken care of initially. There was one that was sold on eBay not too long ago for $20,000. But that was in much less good shape.
Yeah, and they're saying this one's basically going in for a restoration. So to me, it just looks like it must be just going in for a clean and electrical check. It's a very nice looking machine. I would love to have that in my collection as is. I don't know if I'd be brave enough, but they seem to have a quite a large team working on it. Quite a lot of experience there, so I'm looking forward to the follow-on entries on this blog for this machine. I think it's going to be a superb-looking piece of hardware when they're done with it. As I said, I just hope that one day I can actually sit down in front of one, hopefully with the console on a desk, because I can't see my knees moving too easily, being the large, clunky guy that I am. That doesn't exactly look like an ergonomic workstation environment.
No. But these are, yeah, I mean, one of the other great things about this is it's generating great photos of this. I mean, like, you know, I have in the past looked for photos of a Xerox Alto, and there aren't very many good ones out there, but that soon will change. That already has changed to some extent.
Yeah, just the disassembly shots of them getting it pulled down, stripped down for just the general cleaning and checking it out. As you said, it's given us a whole pile of shots that we just didn't have before. You know, it's great to see new photography of these machines, just as in a static display, but to actually have it stripped down for its servicing and to see all those shots of the internals. It's great. Okay, well, moving along, Paul, you have some older tech tweeting.
Yeah, so this is a pretty interesting blog post put up by Chris Osborne at icentricity.com. What his goal was to initially to tweet with a TRS-A new Model 2. So he did that. He used Kermit for CPM to do this, and you know, on June 1st there is a tweet that says sending world's first tweet from a TRS-80 Model 2. And so in this process he used Kermit to do this, and there's kind of some missing features in the TRS-80 Model 2 support for Kermit. It doesn't have hardware flow control, so it'll drop characters. And so he said, all right, well, you know, the source is available, so let's fix this. And so he looked around, and ultimately, I mean, it's kind of, you know, he sort of details this in the blog post, but he had the source, and he wanted to compile it, but it's in something, and so this is where my knowledge of the system is weak, but it's in LASM, L-A-S-M, you know, so the assembler used to compile this, it's an 8080 assembler, and it's targeting L-A-S-M, and this assembler is no longer findable. So I think he was trying to compile it a little bit on the machine itself and having media trouble, and so what he ultimately did was write a kind of like a cross-compiler that would take the LASM, I will now call it, syntax, and then convert it into something that a modern compiler to 8080 code could run. So he's sort of made a kind of a cross-assembler under Linux so that he could fix Kermit. And actually, I'm not sure he ever did fix Kermit. He kind of it looks like he just kind of wandered down this path, and you know, now there's a cross-assembler. So maybe in the future Kermit will be patched. But so if you want to take a look at this, he's got a list of all the he's got a link to his GitHub source for the, you know, preprocessor that puts it in some format that you can assemble, and he's got a links to all the assemblers he's tried out, at least in this process, and pretty interesting. So take a look.
Okay, Carrington, this one I think really suits you. Ancient code. So that'd be ancient code by the ancient programmer, who is no longer the ancient mariner.
This unlocked a world of crazy awesomeness for me, so I wanted to share it for everybody else. I stumbled across something I don't even know where, maybe on Reddit or something, where somebody posted a link to something called Ancient Code, which was just a one-page little summary of some really neat, beautifully detailed little assembler code that a fellow had made for the Apple II way back in the day. And he scanned the pages where he'd handwritten everything out and placed them up on the website. So if you're interested in assembler code and seeing how somebody would put that together and make all the little comments and write down all the little codes and say, here are my opcodes and here are the little sections and working it all out, it's really neat to look at. Like, this is somebody who was very meticulous the way one would have to be back in the day to do assembler code. So that page on its own is the main thing, and we'll link to that, and it's beautiful and it's gorgeous. But while you're there, click over to the main page, because this is on a site I had not heard of called the Codeless Code. And it's spectacular, and I don't understand why this wasn't something that had bubbled up before. So it is ruminations on programming in the style of Zen koans. So I think I am as godless as they come, but I think a Zen koan is these diatribes or little questions that one would ask, or a Zen master would tell a story to somebody to make the student determine, like, do they understand the point of it, or make them question things, make them understand what the nature of Zen stuff is. So these are little tales, little parables about programmers, and as if they are ancient things. And so, and like a student would ask a question, and a master would say this, and the student would go off, and then he would, and it's amazing. So it's about programming, but it's not about code. It's about the mentality of programming and the mindset of it in the format of like ancient parables of the master programmer and the student programmer. And it's amazing and gorgeous. And they're so wonderfully done, and there's more than 200 of them. What are they now? 227 or 232, I guess. I mean, it's crazy. They're even rated in terms of their geekiness, and so you can sort by that. And I just love them, and I've been working my way through them, and it's truly beautiful. Like, it's such a beautiful site. It's by a person named QI, which I think is also a Kung Fu term or a Zen term? I don't know. I'm actually out of my depth here. But it's beautiful. The site is beautiful. The stories are beautiful and will unlock things inside you. So if you're interested in programming, if you're interested in code, not even about the particulars of a programming language, but about the mindset of the programmer, about the lessons one would learn, about parables of the ancient programmer, this is totally a site to go to. I'm quite excited about it. I'm delighted to share it. I think it's gorgeous. And if any of you knew about it before then now, shame on you for not telling me, because it's one of the most neat things I've come across in ages.
Shame on me, because I have seen this before, but I have not. I've also enjoyed it, and then like I forget about it, and then a year later I see it again somewhere. It's like, oh right, that site, and I look at it some more. It is a lot of fun.
I have just bookmarked that one.
Yeah, definitely worth going through.
Yeah, gonna make some time. Yeah, I might actually see if I can offline all of that so that I can take it with me on my little flight that I'll be doing soon. I think this will be some good reading.
It should be an audiobook. It would be something that would be great. It should be read. And I love it. And there's these great little stories that make you think about stuff. And I adore it. I can't even express how much I adore this thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we also had an email from Paul Horton regarding the complete BBC Games archive. So we'll include a link to that. Now, not only is it an archive of the games, they're supplied as disk images, and it also incorporates JSBeeb to allow you to play the games in browser. So if you've never played any BBC Micro games, this website is a good place for you to go. Now, it is all part of a project, and we will include a link to the star.org.uk forums where if you believe that you can assist the guys in this project, you can register on that forum and get in contact with them. And guys, what do you think of all those wonderful BBC Micro games there?
That's pretty wild. I hadn't seen it until I saw the email and the feedback, but it's laid out a little bit like the archive.org pages. Mm. So it's like it's a whole list of screenshots, and there's a play button, and I have, you know, I've hit the play button on one of them so far, and it played. But it's very what's the word I'm looking for? It's they're trying for a lot here.
Mm. Mm.
What is the word I'm looking for? Well, anyway, it'll come to me in a dream.
It's coming through. Coming through pretty good. So yeah, they've can select by at the moment by name. There's also by the pages. They mentioned in the email that and also the forum that they're wanting to also sort by genre and theme. So just to make it a lot easier. So if you don't know of a specific game that you're looking for, then you've at least got the ability ultimately of going in for the different styles of games. So it'd be really interesting to see what kind of metadata they associate with each of these images, so that you can sort of start getting a display of options that more suit what you're looking for. But
I know that definitely in the Apple II world, I've come across this a lot, where people are like, oh, there was this game, it had a frog.
Yeah.
And they don't know what it's called. And that, you know, comes up over and over again. People are trying to find out if this is, you know, what game was this, and people suggest things. And so that would be really useful to be able to search for. I can definitely see that. I mean, maybe you can do that to some extent now, but that's definitely useful in this kind of nostalgic endeavor, where, you know, you're trying to do something that you last did when you were 10, and you only vaguely remember things from when you were 10.
And that's the first problem. It's that vague memory. And occasionally I've managed to say, like, I'm trying to figure out what game it was, and I was actually blending two games together into one. But
And you also get this feeling like, oh, actually, that wasn't as good as I thought.
No, yeah. Oh, let's see. Yeah, I'm
our opening topic.
Yeah. I wish I didn't find it.
I played just a couple of games as well on this site, and I was quite excited. I bookmarked it. I'm quite excited for it to be there. But I encountered something that is kind of typical of an emulator, because you don't have the real hardware, and the real hardware is assumed by the people who make the program. So I was playing this program where you're supposed to be going through a magical world with fairies or something like that. And it said, okay, you can only press the red keys. I'm like, I don't know which ones were red. So I had to Google it. I'm like, the function keys. Turns out on the BBC Micro were the red ones. But like, it's, so it tells me to press red keys. I'm like, I don't know what you mean by that.
Yeah, you could have said function key, but you had to say the red key.
Because it's for kids, so they just press the red key. I'm like, I don't know which one's red.
I'm a very old adult. What one should I push? And what I like in the email, he said, and please give a plug to the competition at everygaminggoing.com. So that's someone who's got another Every game sort of compilation website, and they've been doing some assisting with the BBC Micro website with the emulator there. So a little bit of happy work between, I can't really say the competition, but people aren't staying within their own little ivory tower. They're stepping out and helping each other, and I just love that.
Well, I think the goal, probably the goal of both of them is to have a complete, you know, like get all of the games, all of the BBC games that there are. And I think Every Game Going is trying to do that for multiple platforms. I think they have a way to go. I hit browse by machine and hit Apple II. And it says, you know, the following is a list of what we believe to be the complete list of 22 games written and released for the Apple II.
Okay. There must be quite a lot of variations of each of those 22 games.
but I mean, it's and of course, there's a certain sense in which you'll never make it, because you know, I wrote a couple dumb games that I never gave anybody, and you know, half of the sectors that they were on are now rotten. But yeah, it's ambitious, by the way, is the word I was looking for before.
Mm, and especially when also some games and some companies, they didn't publish beyond their own country. Mm-hmm. Because now we are talking about a time where things weren't as easy to distribute as they are today. Today, you know, the world is your market. Back then, you basically had to dig your market out from wherever you could.
I literally, 5 minutes before we podcasted, I went on YouTube to try to watch a video that said it was not available in my territory. So I don't know that we've really moved beyond that.
Yes, but at least you can go into your VPN software and flick your server location.
As long it's as like you were looking over my shoulder.
Yes, and until you start trying to play with Netflix and those others. But yeah, our perfect world has a few rough edges at the moment, but we find a way of getting around them or smoothing them off or just kicking them to the curb. Okay, well, that would appear to be the news for this episode. So we'll take a break here and a message from our sponsor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You come into your office, grab a cup of coffee.
Morning, Fred.
And a Xerox machine presents your morning mail on a screen.
What's the mail this morning? This one looks interesting. Let's take a look at this. I'm going to need a couple of copies of this.
Push a button, and the words and images you see on the screen appear on paper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Fred. You know, Fred, I think everybody on the routing list should see this.
Push another button, and the information is sent electronically to similar units around the corner or around the world. This is an experimental office system. It's in use now at the Xerox Research Center in Palo Alto, California. Soon, Xerox systems like this will help you manage your most precious resource, information.
Anything else? Flowers. Well, what flowers? My anniversary. I forgot.
And we're back. So, host retro computing gift idea. Well, I thought, instead of something for me, I should be looking for something special for that special someone in my life. And what better place to go than somewhere that does silver jewelry? So, I have here a silver Dalek with a pink bow pendant. Now, for that special little science fiction geek in your life. Oh, guys, what do you think? Do you think that a pink bow is fetching on a Dalek?
Nope. I have an issue with the whole how do you make a female put a bow on it thing. That's what I'm saying. I got an issue with our choice this time.
It is a bit Ms. Pac-Man, isn't it?
Yes. I'm just saying, got a problem with this. I think we should link off to the Feminist Frequency video that will tell us why we're all evil, because yes. This is not good. But whatever. It's our choice. It's all good. Yeah. I'm just like to say that I've got a problem with it.
Well, if you don't read the description, it doesn't have to be a girl Dalek.
This is true.
Silver Dalek.
I'm not being
bow.
Gender normative. It can be whatever it wants, but still, we all know what's going on here.
Okay.
That said, I love Doctor Who.
As well as that, they do have some other wonderful jewelry items in there. Cufflinks, pendants, earrings, keyring fobs. So there is quite a lot there. One of my favorites, actually, is the green eyeball pendant. I could see that as being a good keyring fob as well.
And the Dalek earrings are non-gendered. That is, neither has a ribbon or a bow tie.
Oh, yeah, I was just looking at those. I like those.
But I'm sure you'll find something special in here for your special someone.
We don't all have that.
Maybe you can find a special someone first.
I almost feel sorry for you.
And then I speak.
Okay. So, on to things more retro. Carrington, you have the mic. Apple II Business Graphics Package. I thought you were the games man.
I know, but it looks like a little suitcase. I kind of love it, so totally useless nowadays, but I adore it. I think it's outrageously priced. $150 starting bid, there are no bids, or $500 buy it now. I have no idea if that's actually reasonable. I think no software is reasonable for $500, not even current Adobe stuff. But this is neat. So it's four discs. It's the Apple II Business Graphics software package. But it's complete and it's neat looking. And it comes in a little black box that opens up kind of suitcase style. And I think it's gorgeous. So I'm picking that as my main choice. I'm not actually recommending anybody buy it, but it's neat. So if you're going to be browsing eBay and look at our links, take a look at this because it's a neat thing to actually look at. And I have a second small choice as well. Also probably not worth buying, but also neat to look at.
at an Apple IIe enhancement kit. Well, I guess it would just be an Apple II enhancement kit if you don't, if you already got the E, you're done. But in case you've been using your Apple II and thinking my life would be better if only it was enhanced, this is an enhancement kit. Normally, you just, you know, fire off the ROMs. Everybody does it nowadays. But this is a neat one, and it's super vintage. Comes with a letter dated 1986, and I dig it. I dig it a lot. So if you want to enhance your Apple II, then this is a really cool vintage way to do it. And it's $40. Buy it now. I think it's gorgeous. So this one, I wouldn't actually recommend purchasing either, but it's also neat to look at. So two things you should not buy. Those are my choices.
So this
can someone clue me in on what the enhancement actually is? Like, what does this do?
Well, I will tell you. The enhancement kit. There are a couple of changes in the ROMs. It allows for mouse text, which is sort of like graphical text that allows you to make sort of windowing systems within the text screen.
It's going
to
be huge.
And there are a couple of changes to the ROMs. But one of the things that's cool about this, as opposed to getting the actual sort of like Apple-sanctioned 2E enhancement, is that there's a switch. So you can switch back and forth. So you can switch between enhanced and unenhanced. So if there was something that depended on the old ROM, you can switch back away from it. So that's kind of cool.
Or I guess you could use it as a ROM switcher, like not even just the old ROM. You could put in different things. It's a ROM switcher.
Yeah, so I wonder if, in fact, so there was a sort of a pirate's aid called the Senior Prom that would do this on 2Es so that you could put in, sort of like a special ROM so when you hit reset, it would not do the normal reset stuff, but would dump you straight into control, basically. Or... you know, do some other stuff, possibly, you know, saving memory so that you could then store it later. And I wonder if this is somewhat equivalent. Might be.
It's just neat. I don't.
It is neat.
Recommend anybody actually buy it, but it was really cool. I was like, oh, that's nice looking. So I'm happy to have looked at it. Those are my choices.
Nice. I could say something about the business graphics thing too. It is super complete except for one thing. It should have had a slip cover.
Now that you say that, it does look like it should have a slipcover. Well, then I don't like my choice anymore. Don't even look at it. Don't look at it. It's a monster. Do you have one of those, Paul? Do you have five or six of those sets?
I think I have a couple, yeah. I think I have one that's still wrapped, actually.
Oh, God.
So not only do you have the slipcover, you've still got the shrink wrap over it.
I'll open that for you if you'd like.
I bet you would.
Mwah. Okay. My find, I decided I'd go looking for some examples of BBC Micro. So I have here an auction for a Model B. It's refurbished, tested, and working, which makes a great change from those eBay auctions where it's basically untested, I don't know, don't send it back. It's good to actually have something listed as refurbished, tested, and working. So it's basically just waiting for you to open up your wallet, part with some money, and get going on it. So this is just for the console itself. So you'll need to add a floppy drive for this. So I've included a link to an auction for a PACE disk drive for the BBC Micro. Its box comes with all the cables. So that will get you connected. Now, you also will need to display. You can set your micro up to a TV, but it comes with a RGB port. So if you don't have an RGB monitor or a SCART TV connected TV that supports RGB and the cable to suit, you can get a video HDMI converter. So just like many other machines out there where you can convert the machine video to VGA or HDMI, here's one for your BBC Micro. So a little bit more expensive than the machine itself, but at least it will make it a lot easier to display on a LCD monitor. So, yeah. For a little bit of an outlay, you could have the physical machine, or, like me, you can enjoy the BBC Micro website and play those games in your browser.
The red keys are the function keys.
That would be the red keys across the top there, would it, Carrington?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Google is so handy at times, isn't it?
Those are the things really that make it so distinctive, though, too. I mean, like, that's you know, the red keys are very much part of this look.
Yeah, just the whole style of it. You bring that up now. I think that the in-browser option for that might actually be somewhat enhanced by actually having the keyboard available there so that you can sort of see what's there and do your own mappings or something along those lines. But no, you're right. It those keys are basically, to me, one of the highlight features on there, quite literally, compared to the quite business-oriented almost, that plain beige and black aesthetic. But the red function keys just really highlight it, make it quite an interesting machine.
I mean, I say this every time they come up, but I still would really like to have one of these. there is somebody, that actually isn't too, I don't see it right now, but there is someone who does regularly refurbish these. Maybe it is in fact the seller, and make them available sometimes with added RAM or like, you know, SD card options in there and stuff. They're still, for me, they would still need to be converted so that I could, you know, view them on North American TVs and plug them into US outlets and stuff. But
That's basically where, if you don't have an RGB monitor available, the converter, at least most of us have a HDMI monitor or two that we can push towards our retro machines.
And that gets rid of the PAL problem.
Yeah, I was thinking that I might want one of those, even if I don't get the BBC Micro, just for any PAL machine I wind up with in the future.
So you're going to buy a video adapter for a computer you don't even have. You got a problem, Paul.
Hey, don't knock him, mate.
Michael has plenty of, like...
Yeah, I've gone and bought a universal power supply for a computer which I don't own yet.
But it's universal.
It's universal, yes. So it's in anticipation that one day I will have an Apple IIc Plus.
When you're going to have 8 ROMs for it, right?
Oh, yeah, and that's the other thing. I've ordered a ROM upgrade for it as well. So not only do I not have the machine to plug in to my power supply, I've ordered a ROM upgrade so that I can have a better experience on the machine I don't own.
Oh, I've been meaning to order one of those too for Kansas Fest. Whoops, I'll get around to that.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's. I suppose it comes down to, oh, that looks very useful. I better get it now, otherwise I may never, ever get it again. So.
Moscow rule of shopping, yes. Buy bread if you see bread.
Yes, that is actually quite true. So, I should put up a page on my blog of something to do of bits that I have for computers that I don't have computers for the bits.
Very succinct, yes.
Or junk I can't use. Okay, Paul, you've gone for a bit of a trawl on eBay. What have you found this time?
Well, the first weird thing I found is an NRI digital computer model 832. It is a weird little blinky lighty switchy computer trainer thing. From like the 1970s. It is a National Radio Institute 832, probably the first commercially available computer kit.
Look at the wires. Oh my
God. designed in 1970 and 71. And it was part of a training program. It has 16 bytes programmable with slide switches on the front, you know, for input. But anyway, so so if you're not looking at the eBay auction, if you're listening to the podcast, you might well not be. It's this a silver box that kind of looks like a cash register or something. And along the left side, it's silver. It has red panels and then black switches and LEDs in these panels. And along the left side is the computer memory, which appears to be 16 bytes with a little on-off toggle switches. And if you open it up, it has six boards with many, many wires and a power supply. And I don't know, it's very cool looking. It's a very simplistic trainer, but it's actually quite old. I mean, you know, so probably the first commercially available computer kit. Like, you know, that kind of old. And I think it's weird to have even found this on eBay. Oh. It's selling for a non-trivial amount, but not a huge amount either. It's $551 buy it now. So who knows if it will still be there. I think it was just listed like today. So
I suspect that's actually a good deal for this thing.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. It's so pretty wild. So take a look at the pictures. They're as good pictures as I've seen of this. The Computer History Museum has one and has some pictures, but not of the inside. So,
because they're ashamed of the inside with those wires.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. And so another thing that's good about this auction, I mean, not only it's powered on such that, you know, some of the little LEDs come on and, you know, who knows what they mean. But it also comes with some of the manuals. So I think on oldcomputermuseum.com, there are some other photos of some more manuals that would have come with this. But this is a pretty complete set, and I think you'd actually be able to understand how to use it at least a little bit with this. And I think it was supposed to be just sort of training. It's like one step up from those little logic kits and a step down from like a Heathkit, you know, ET3400. So anyway,
and the little lights work on it and everything. This is a sweet find.
Yeah, if I felt like I had, you know, 551 plus 19 or whatever free, I might have just bought this and not even talked about it. But I don't think I'm going to jump on this. So take a look at the pictures, regardless of if the auction has ended. All right, let's see what else. Another weird thing I found was a Commodore Max. I'd never heard of a Commodore Max. But this is, and it has a lot of Japanese on it. From what I understand, it predates the Commodore 64 by a little bit. It's sort of in between a VIC-20 and a Commodore 64. It was maybe only just in Japan. It looks nothing like either one of those two.
Looks like a Tandy Coco.
Or like a TRS-80 Model 1 or something, kind of.
Mm.
Yeah, it's got that the silver plastic sort of Radio Shack feel about it.
And a keyboard that hates you.
Yeah.
A keyboard that will remind you with every press that it doesn't like you. Look at that space bar. Oh, my goodness.
I think it's an unusual machine. It is being, the first bid is $600. You can buy it now if you want to buy it for $800. But, but it's a weird thing. If you were looking for, if you're not deep, deep, deep into the Commodore machines, you may well have never heard of this, like I had never heard of this. So take a look at the pictures. It's nice to see the pictures.
Pretty crazy. It looks like it has the relative high-res text, like at least 40 columns of text like a Commodore 64 does. But the screenshot shows that when it boots up, it says it has 510 bytes free.
Ooh, excellent.
It's not a lot. So this is like a 1K computer, maybe? Maybe 2K? I don't know how much the basic takes up, I guess. It might take up more than...
That is not many much. Bytes. That is a very small number of bytes.
I can't stop looking at this membrane keyboard, though. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but there's in the lower right corner, there are arrow keys. But instead of the four arrow keys, you only get two. One's up and down, one's left and right. It's like, yeah, we'll go which way we decide. Like, how do you know which way it's going? It just says one, it's the up and down key. The other is the left and right key. So if it doesn't move the cursor, it's done what it says it's going to do. Right. Oh, it's glorious. And the function keys too. F1 and F2. Why not? It's like everything. Oh, I love it. Love it.
I wonder if that's what the Commodore key...
Maybe it's a rocker switch. Maybe the Commodore key is like a shift key. I don't know.
I guess you hold down shift for those things.
I would guess it's to go up, you hit shift down.
But yeah.
Oh. No, to go down, you go shift up.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Right. It'd be a pretty cool thing to have, but I'd prefer to have it.
No, it wouldn't.
I'd like to have it not at $600 or $800.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so those are the two main weird ones. There's another couple that I'll just mention. There's a computerized 1984 computer game, which is it's the game that lets you play around with computers. It's like a board game kind of thing. a game that lets you play around with a computer without having one. So it's for ages 10 to adult, 2 to 6 players. It has little floppy disk looking things called software application cards, which I think are,
I want to play this at Kansas Fest, guys, but it won't ship to Canada.
Ah.
Good thing Kansas Fest is not in Canada then.
Yeah.
Buy it and send it to yourself.
Well, you laugh, but I'm going to try to.
I cannot talk about this.
No. So we talked about the last game that they then talked about, what's that game that we already brought that we're going to bring? Loadrunner. We're going to bring that to Kansas Fest. They were talking about that on the Open Apple podcast recently, saying they were hoping somebody would buy it to bring to Kansas Fest. I was listening going, yes, we did. Our podcast bought it before your podcast could buy it.
But anyway, the game itself, I'm not sure it's fun.
It may well not be fun. Amazingly fun. It looks amazing. It comes in a tube.
But anyway, it's interesting to look at. Yeah, it's very strange. And then it's sort of slightly more pedestrian than everything else that I just wanted to mention. There are a couple of Osborne executives listed. This is the OCC2. It is the follow-up to the OCC1, slightly better, slightly bigger screen. This one is better than some that I've seen in that it comes with a bunch of original software, some of the manuals, and it actually also has what might be a hard drive in it. It has this Osborne Drive C thing that connects into external video. It connects into a printer port. It has an extra accessory in it that you might not easily be able to get any other way. So might be worth looking at that if you were looking for an OCC2. Also, it is going to sell at whatever the market allows. Its current bid is $26. It would be $77 to ship. So it's not trivial shipping, but it's a heavy thing. So anyway, that's it. I'm out.
I've never understood the appeal of the little suitcase computers with their tiny monitors. They look like props from the movie Brazil. I don't understand why people like these things. Back then, didn't get it. Now I don't get it. Just don't get it.
Jack, what have you found? And then does it have the potential to out-weird Paul's?
I don't know about that. It is not a suitcase computer. It is a tiny computer. It's the Atari Portfolio. This thing was from the early 90s. It ran some kind of DOS and had like some built-in applications for like word processing, spreadsheet, that sort of thing. And has a little tiny screen. I think it's like an 80 by 12 column type of thing. No, maybe it's not 80. It's probably 40 columns. It's a little black and white screen. Not very good screen, honestly, I don't think. But kind of cool. I never had one of these. I've always been curious about this. A lot of these sell for $100 and more. This one has a starting bid right now of 40 euros. Only 2 days left, but actually no bids placed at all, which is kind of weird. I think the reason it's not being bid on is that it has a French keyboard.
Mm. Ooh la la.
Scaring off everybody.
But it seems like that would actually be better, wouldn't it? I mean, like, wouldn't that make it more interesting and rare?
You would think so.
And there's not a lot of differences between the French keyboard and the English keyboard.
Mm.
No. And I suspect that there's a reasonable chance that those things are essentially software mapped in the system configuration some way, so you can just switch back to English and use it as if it were an English keyboard.
Oui.
Anyway.
Except for the confusing assignment of letters on the keyboard.
Exactly. Oh, it is. Yeah, it's Azerty. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah,
you'd have to play with the keycaps, but no, it's a nice. That's a nice looking portfolio.
And considering that there are 2 days left and zero bids so far, even though we surely will not have this podcast out within 2 days, there's a good chance it'll be relisted. I would guess because no one is bidding on this damn thing.
But if
you're looking for an Atari portfolio, there you go.
Some nice shots. So again, some nice shots of older machine. But you're right. It probably will get relisted, especially something like this.
Well, maybe if everyone in France is watching the Euro and not paying attention to this.
watching the football, so not watching the eBay.
Two things to note. One is that the primary expansion capability on this was a PCMCIA card slot for whatever you could do with that, which was probably limited to the things that actually had support for that version of DOS on this thing. The other thing was that if you ever saw the movie Terminator 2, the young John Connor uses one of these devices to hack into an ATM or something.
Ah.
So does this one come with the ATM interface cable?
Yeah, pay for itself.
No, it's been exactly banned in France.
Or someone else can pay for itself, yes. Okay.
Well, I see they show up, thought of it, running a spreadsheet.
That'd be so much fun doing a spreadsheet on that little monitor.
Yeah.
Four rows, four columns. It's very nice. Yeah.
Okay, so closing discussions. Carrington, you're scooping, are you?
Am I? Oh, yes. So we'll mention Kevin Savitz because you guys seem to want to mention him in every show, so I'll get on board with that. He recently tweeted about something that I think is going to be coming up on a future Antic episode, but it hasn't come out yet, so I figured let's talk about it now and scoop them. That'll show you for mentioning things on Twitter, Kevin. So it's actually a really cool story, and so I want people to be aware of it so they can go when it is in Antic and get the whole deal. So there was Databar, the monthly barcode software magazine, were published only a little bit in 1983. In fact, I think maybe there was only the one episode, one issue. But in it, there was a bunch of, you know, those barcode strips that had software. And somebody named Dogox, D-O-E-G-O-X, Dogox, on Twitter, wrote a Python script to decode those barcodes without needing the actual scanner. And then Travis Goodspeed helped get it into... I'm always like, pause. Which of these words am I allowed to say? We'll just say POCGTFO. So that's the International Journal of Proof of Concept, or other things that I shouldn't say on the podcast, which is awesome and glorious and beautiful and the best thing on the internet. And so there you go. But this is a really neat thing. So this was software locked away in barcodes and otherwise unavailable that has been unlocked by the power of Python. Super awesome. I look forward to hearing more about it. But meanwhile, if our episode gets published before their episode, we've technically scooped Antic. Take it.
And that's not easy to do when they're on the 2 or 3 day release schedule.
And in personal stuff, I've just been going to a lot of concerts lately. I went to see the Dixie Chicks, of all people, and I had front row center seats. It was crazy. So for a big concert. And then I saw the Double Clicks, who played in front of maybe 50 people here in Toronto. And frankly, the Double Clicks was a better concert. It was amazing. So highly recommend that band if you like nerdy sort of stuff. A couple of sisters from Portland, and I love their music very much. So hooray for the Double Clicks.
Nice. I just want to point out that current issue of POC GTFO in question also has a nice article about implementing a Turing machine in Vim. Really weird. They lost me in the first couple paragraphs, but it was really cool to read.
That is essentially the slogan of the magazine. They'll lose you in the first couple of paragraphs, but it's pretty cool to read. That is pretty much my experience. I'd say 50% of the things I read, but I still read it because it's still amazing.
Okay. Well, not much happening here at the moment, but I just thought I'd just like to remind our listeners that the afternoon and the evening of the 7th of July that I'll be in Seattle and at the Living Computer Museum. So if you want to drop by, have a chat, and we can check out all that nice retro hardware in the Living Computer Museum.
I very much hope I will get there at some point, but I will not see you there.
Yeah, I'm. This is part of my grand tour on the way to Kansas Fest. So I'll be in Seattle on the 7th of July, then just making my way through Canada and then back down to Kansas City and Missouri for the 19th. So it should be a great time. Plan to catch up with folks. Already reached out to some other retro enthusiasts along the way, so really looking forward to kicking it off at the Living Computer Museum. Cool. So, anyone else got anything final to add? Paul?
Yeah, well, I'll put in, since we're talking about people, you know, like concerts we've been at, I got to see The Cure, which...
Oh, cool.
My guess is that people listening to this will, you know who that is, at least. But I think I last saw them, I don't know, it was like 29 years ago or something like that. Pretty much the same thing. It was like just being right back there. It was pretty impressive.
The last time I saw them was also like probably 1988 or something.
Yeah.
I have never seen them, but I would very much like to.
It was wild, and somehow I knew everything but three things they played. I don't know. Anyway, it was a neat experience. So, but otherwise, yeah. I'm sensing that Kansas Fest is rushing up upon me, and I'm not ready for it, as usual.
I have just today figured out what my door will be, so I'm starting to work on that.
You are way ahead of me. Yeah. I'm supposed to give a talk, actually. I did succeed. I think last time I mentioned that I might be giving a talk. I am now giving a talk, but we'll see what it's about.
Is it about the cure?
It is not. We've narrowed it down by one.
Of all the things in the world, it's not about the cure.
Carrington, on the note of the door competition for Kansas Fest, I just thought I'd let you know that I've ordered all my bits and pieces, and they are currently on their way to Kansas Fest. So hopefully I will have all my stuff to do my door. So it'll be dueling doors.
My door will be spread across the entire campus. So bring it.
Do I have to leave you some space on my door then?
But components of my door will take place in multiple locations all across the campus. So I'm thinking big this year.
Okay. And Jack, you've managed to survive your midsummer celebrations. Anything else happening?
Oh, not much.
Not much?
Just
recovering from midsummer.
Recovering from that. Looking forward to some upcoming vacation time to play with my Atari.
Oh, that sounds like quality time.
Portfolio.
Yes. Maybe that.
Abort, retry, ignore. Abort, retry, ignore.
Okay. And on that note, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this show and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us at the Vintage Computer Federation forums. And you can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. Join our discussions in the Facebook group. Just look for RCR Podcast in Facebook and send us a join request. You can always send us your feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network, a good way of finding other retro-themed podcasts. And please do write us a review on iTunes. It will go a long way to helping other people to find the podcast when they're searching through. So everybody, until next time,
Retro Compute.
Oh. Has everyone else got, or anyone else got a full audio recording going? Because I just noticed that there's a mismatch between call recorder says I've got 51 minutes of audio and we've been going for an hour and 3 minutes.
I do not.
I do.
Oh, saved.
Oh, it looks like I'm not recording at all.
Seriously? Fantastic.
Gosh, darn it. Okay.
Start it now, Carrington.
I've started now. For the second half of this video, I'm going to be more clearness.
Definitely in your lexical choices.
Ambitious.
Yeah, it's okay. I have no feet to stand on here.
Whoops. Well, that's my first podcast, so I'm new.
Okay, so anyone else want to start their audio? No, good. Okay, and we're back. I know they say there's no place like home.